Love it when you speak Latin. You been to sea? Sammy hoped she didn't see panic on his face. Just transport, he lied. My husband was on a ship, heavy cruiser. Went down with all hands near Savo Island, August 42. They never found him. Uncle Sam sent me a flag. Casual as you please. Like that first day in the saloon when she'd mentioned her husband. And like then, he didn't know what to say. He said, "Sorry, kid." He pulled her close. She pushed him away, took his hand, and pulled him toward the gains of chance. "Come on, win me something." Sammy threw some baseballs and milk bottles filled with concrete, and threatened them not at all, although Stilton cheered him on and cursed the bottle's stubborn ways. At a shooting gallery, he downed a few metal ducks with a .22, because his father had given him and his brother's BB guns as boys, and he was not a bad shot, although not good enough to win a prize. "Come on, let's kill some clowns," she suggested, pointing toward a booth where you could throw darts to pop the balloon bodies of painted-on clowns. "How about you, little lady?" called a barker as they passed. "Guess you wait for a nickel. I get it wrong and you win a teddy bear." "And you get it right and I'll rip your lips off and stomp them like slugs," replied the cheese. Sammy nodded earnestly to the barker to confirm her conviction. Stilton's weight went unguessed. Sammy finally won her prize when a ping-pong ball he tossed settled into one of 100 baseball-sized goldfish bowls, startling the fish inside somewhat, but which it soon forgot. Stilton held the bowl aloft and looked at the perky orange occupant against the lights of the Ferris wheel. "It looks so lonely, Sammy. Win me another one, so they can both be in the same bowl and have a little goldfish razzmatazz." "I don't think goldfish have razzmatazz," said Sammy. "Well, then how do they have little goldfish?" "Far as I know, the female legs are eggs in the bottom. Then later on the male comes along and fertilizes them." "Really?" "Not exactly sure with goldfish, but that's how it works for trout. We have trout in Idaho. I read a book on them when I was a kid." "Yeah," said the scruffy guy working the goldfish booth. You could have sanded the varnish off a coffee table on his 5 o'clock shadow. "He's got it right." Stilton handed the fish back to 5 o'clock shadow. "Take the sad fish. Give him to a kid. Come, Sammy, I need fun." She took his arm and led him toward the funhouse, with the great yellow letters painted across the red facade reading, "Laugh in the Dark." Sammy bought 2 tickets, and they entered through a giant clown's mouth, stepping through baffles of black fabric until they were stumbling inside a 10-foot-high rotating drum. It wasn't dark yet, but they were laughing and stumbling until they stepped out onto a very mushy field of what must have been black foam rubber. "It's like walking on meatloaf," said the cheese, giggling, as a skeleton dropped from above them and was caught by a red spotlight. Stilton yipped and jumped into Sammy's arms. He carried her through another set of black fabric draperies and into complete darkness. "Should be called pee in the dark," said Stilton.
"Really?"
"Nah, close, though." "Come here, fraidy cat," said Sammy. He smooched her, perhaps a little too zealously for someone who was laughing, and they banged their teeth. Then they separated and felt for chipped teeth with their tongues. People, mostly teenagers, pushed past them in the dark, giggling, groping, and shrieking like joyful heretics at a clown inquisition. Someone pinched Sammy's bottom and he jumped. "Was that you?"
"What?"
said Stilton, her voice sounding about 10 feet away. "Nothing," Sammy said. "I think I might have just made a friend. Stay there, I'll come to you." He found her in the dark and they kissed like they'd been separated for months, clinging to each other as revelers bumped into them, shrieked and laughed and stumbled on. They blundered together through another set of baffles, these made of some kind of black gauze which felt like spiderwebs against their faces, onto a dimly lit floor that shifted and tilted, sending them staggering one way, then stumbling another. "I don't think I'm drunk enough to walk this way," said the cheese. "Relax, ma'am, you're in good hands," Sammy said. "I'm a bartender." He pulled her through the next door and ducked under the outstretched hand of a moaning mummy that pivoted on an axis at his waist and swung his arm back, just missing delivering a backhand to the cheese. Sammy pulled her down just in time when they crouched beneath the bandaged automaton. The mummy moaned again. "The smug's got a moobox in him," said the cheese. Sammy pulled the pint from his overcoat and unscrewed the cap. "Pardon?" he said. "A moobox," said the cheese, taking the pint from him. "We sell them at the 5 and dime. It's like a little can, and when you turn it over, it moves like a cow." The mummy waved over their heads again and moaned. That does sound like a cow, Sammy said. Moobox, the cheese explained. She pointed at the pint of old tennis shoes. No chaser?
Rehearsal's over, Sammy said.
She went a little cross-eyed as she took a swig, scrunched up her face like a kid eating a lemon, then shook her head until the burn settled down. There were tears in her eyes when she held the pint out to Sammy as if it contained a cocktail of nitroglycerin and monkey spit, which is to say, with careful disgust. Smooth, she gasped. Good for cleaning engine parts, too, Sammy said, braving a swallow himself and capping the bottle. Let's get out of here. They raced away from the mooing mummy and made their way across the ceiling of an upside-down room and through a mirror maze to stumble, arm in arm, out onto the midway. The smell of sea air, popcorn, cotton candy, and cigarette smoke washed over them. Sammy bought them snow cones, red for her and blue for him. And, at Stilton's suggestion, doctored the chili treats with the last of the old tennis shoes. Not bad, said the cheese. Could use some more blue, Sammy said. They walked by the rides and souvenir stands, and tried to find takers for bets in the merry-go-round. I'm giving 6-5 odds on the funny-looking kid on the camel, Stilton called, waving a fan of skee-ball tickets in the air to show she was legit. I think that's a giraffe, Sammy said. 5-6 on the funny-looking kid to win, then, said Stilton. Sammy pulled her away before she could find any takers, and they ended up in front of a caricature artist, who sat on a stool, wearing an artist's smock and a beret.
Pin-up for the little ladies for only a buck.
No. Stilton tried to walk away.
I think she's worth giving a second look, said the artist. Don't you?
Absolutely, said Sammy. He swung Stilton around by the arm. Come on, Toots. I think you're worth it, don't you?
Don't call me.
She caught herself falling for the bait. Ah, hell. She slurped the last of her snow cone, handed the soggy paper wrapper to Sammy, then sat down on the stool opposite the artist and let her trench coat fall off her shoulders.
Tell me pretty, she said.
A look passed between Stilton and the artist that made Sammy think she might slug the guy.
No work for me, ma'am, said the artist,
and he commenced drawing, holding his drawing board out of Sammy's sight. Fine, Sammy said. He walked away and fought with a half a book of matches to get a cigarette lit, noticing that the breeze had changed directions and was blowing offshore. It was warm, a rare condition on a summer night at the San Francisco beach.
How about you undo a button or three in the front there, Toots?
Said the artist, when he thought Sammy was out of earshot.
How about I bop you in the biza so hard it spins your beret around? Said the cheese.
Cheese, said the artist.
No need to get tough. And don't call me Toots, said the cheese.
The artist finished his sketch about the time that Sammy was grinding out the butt of his smoke on the gravel of the midway.
Voila,
said the artist, in perfect fucking French. He flipped the drawing around. Sammy took a look, then took a step back and whistled. Holy moly.
You're a lucky guy, said the artist.
Yes, I am, said Sammy. The caricature portrayed Stilton in the pose of the classic Rosie the Riveter She Can Do It poster from the war, a blonde flexing a bicep, her hair tied up in a polka-dot bandana, the classic chambray shirt. Except this Rosie was facing the artist, not looking over her shoulder, and the shirt was unbuttoned to the point that exaggerated bits of the cheese were about to burst out for the world to see. It was Stilton, all right, but rounder in the places where she was round, and sharper in the places where she was sharp. Drop-dead sexy.
I should be on the side of a bomber or something, Sammy said.
That'll be a buck, said the artist. You got it. Sammy handed the guy a dollar. The artist tore the drawing from his sketchbook and started to roll it up. No, not yet, Sammy said. He took the drawing, held it up, and compared details with the model, his eyes darting from Stilton to the drawing and back.
I need a look at this Rosie.
You two have a good evening, sir, said the artist with a wink to the cheese.
Wendy,
Stilton said as she stood and joined Sammy in admiring the drawing, turning her back on the artist.
Rosie the Riveter was for girls who worked in airplane factories. In the shipyards, we were Wendy the Welders.
What a dame, Sammy said. Then he turned from the drawing and kissed her.
You like it?
She pouted with anticipation.
I like the model, Sammy said.
I like the model a lot.
Let's go for a walk, Stilton said.
It got warm out, Sammy said. You notice?
Oh, yeah, she said.
Sammy rolled the drawing up and fixed it with the rubber band the artist had given him and tucked it in his pocket.
They walked arm in arm around Playland at the beach, then out of the park and up into the dunes. They found a sheltered hollow, where all they could see was the stars and sand, and calliope music from the merry-go-round sailed over them on a warm offshore wind. They lay down between her trench coat and his overcoat, wrapped the stars around them like a blanket, and made love until time disappeared. Time returned, just before dawn, dressed in a chill fog, and Sammy awoke to the caricaturist drawing poking him in the ribs. "Hey," he said, "how did that guy know you worked at a shipyard during the war?"
Chapter 10 Surprise. When Sal Gabelli came through the back door of the saloon, he found a wooden crate, about 3 feet square, with the words "Danger, Live Reptiles" stenciled on the side in big black letters.
"What wacky shit is this?"
Sal said to himself, and the four mutts were waiting behind him outside the door. Sal had been experimenting with his dog pizza idea, and dogs of various sizes and colors had been attracted to his experiments. Now they met him at the door every morning when he opened the joint and waited for the next incarnation of dog pizza, cooked up by Sal's wife the night before.
"No pizza today, you mooches," said Sal,
and he slammed the door in their faces.
"Fole donna!"
"Crazy weasel," the dogs barked in chorus, before they kicked Sal from their hind paws like shit-stained grass, and wandered off to find better fare. It is well known that all North Beach dogs bark in Italian. There was an envelope stapled to the crate addressed to Sam Tiffin, care of Sal's, with "Private" stamped upon it in red. Sal considered for 3 full seconds not opening the envelope before constructing a 5-pronged rationale for doing so, which was as follows. 1. It is addressed to my saloon. 2. Sammy took the night off. 3. The relief bartender, Benny, does not do my side work and is therefore a bum. 4. The gimp has a lot of goddamn nerve receiving packages here. 5. Fuck him. Pookie O'Hara's probably gonna put him in a sack anyway. Sal ripped the envelope from the crate and paused an additional 2 seconds while he considered carefully steaming it open, then ran through his 5 rationales, settling quickly upon 5, and tore it open. The letter inside read, "Sammy boy, let someone who knows what he's doing open this. These boogers are quick as lightning and twice as deadly. Hope your business venture works out. Headed to China. Be back in September. See you then. Cheers. Bakker." Sal read the letter again, looked at the crate, then read the letter again, then set it on the crate. He could always say he found it that way, no harm, no foul. "It was open when I came in," Sal practiced in his head.
"Must have been Benny. You ask me, that guy is a bum. Never changes out the keg at the end of his shift."
That figured out, Sal made his way over to the tap, put a Pilsner glass under it, gave it a pull, and sure enough, the tap sputtered and spit foam into the glass, then hissed. Empty.
"Oh, bum, I tell you."
Now, Sal was faced with the dilemma of switching out the keg, which he did not want to do, or opening the crate, which he very much did. What kind of scam was Two Toes running, anyway? Who did he think that Danger, Live Reptile rigmarole was going to fool? And why not have it sent to his house instead of the bar? Unless Two Toes had counted on it arriving when he was working. And it had arrived when Benny was filling in, so the relief bum had accepted the crate. That had to be it. Had Two Toes found a business angle and not cut Sal in? Would he dare? Were the warnings on the crate just to keep the law from checking the package? Did he owe the gimp the privacy? Had Sammy come through putting the Dorothys together for the Bohemians? He had not. That task had fallen 100% on Sally Gabb. Two Toes might have made a nice cache of cabbage if he'd done his part, but he hadn't. See 5. Fuck him. He didn't deserve discretion. Sal returned to the back room and eyed the crate. It had to be illegal or at least shady, either one of which put it in Sal's domain, because he was the implied boss of all things shady and or illegal that took place in the saloon. Whatever game Two Toes was running, Sal was taking a piece. He gave the crate a little bump with the heel of his hand, and it tipped up an inch, then thumped to the tile. It wasn't heavy, so it wasn't booze. Wrong size crate, besides. The only kind of booze you had to smuggle anymore was absinthe. And nobody wanted it anyway because it tasted like ass, and cost too much or something that might poison you dead. He gave the crate another tip and let it thump down. Nope. Nothing heavy. He'd be surprised if it was even full. Sal grabbed the crate by two corners and gave it a good shaking. A sliding, really. There was definitely something in there. It sounded like straw. They kept a short crowbar and a hook above the sink that they used to pry open the crates of the few liquors that still shipped in wooden boxes. Mostly scotch and a few Dago Reds that they stocked for the neighborhood old guys. That would do. Sal snatched the crowbar from its hook and returned to the crate. He worked the crowbar under one corner of the lid, popped it with his palm to give it some bite, and put his weight on it. The nail screeched, and the corner of the crate came up an inch. Once a bootlegger, always a bootlegger, Sal thought. How many crates had he had to pry open fast during Prohibition? Canadian whiskey sailed into the bay on pleasure craft and was quickly repackaged in fruit and vegetable crates, under real fruit and vegetables before it was rowed ashore. Sal attacked the next corner with the crowbar and levered it down hard. Nails creaked. The lid lifted 2 more inches. He worked the short end of the crowbar around the edge of the lid like he was opening a big can, and the lid came loose. Sal leaned the lid against the side of the crate, then peered in. Nothing. Half full with those curled wood turnings they used to pack dishes and teacups. Nothing was nesting in it. Just a box full of straw, really. But it had been heavier than that. Sal grabbed a handful of straw and held it aloft. Nothing. He poked at the rest of the straw, stirred it around, hooked the crowbar into it, and turned some of it over. Nothing. But there in the corner, something brown. He leaned into the crate and caught it with the tips of his fingers. A canvas bag.
2 tons, you fuckstick,
he said aloud, his voice a prelude in disappointment. The canvas bag was tied at the top, and while it may have once held 50 pounds of flour or rice, now it held nothing at all. In fact, one corner of it was torn, tattered, as if it had been chewed by rats. There was a noxious smell coming off it, too. Sal tossed the sack toward the trash can by the back door. It missed by more than a little, and he angrily hooked it with the crowbar and slung it into the can. Then he saw something move out of the corner of his eye.
The fuck?
He turned to the crate, and a snake was standing there, like a black iron rod, protruding from the crate, its head at Sal's eye level, looking at him, flicking its tongue. Sal felt something like cold electricity run through his body. Adrenaline. He had the crowbar in his hand, ready to swing. It was pointed toward the door. The snake was less than an arm's length away. Sal knew he should do something. Run, fight, dodge, scream. But what he did was nothing at all. The mamba struck, its fangs hooking into the side of Sal's neck, its lower teeth fastening around his Adam's apple while it pumped venom, a long voyage's worth of stored-up venom, into Sal's bloodstream. At which point, Sal did all the things he had thought of doing an instant before. He swung the crowbar. He ducked. He dashed for the door. He screamed a high-pitched terror yodel, and he pulled the door open into his face, then he bounced and fell back, hitting his head on the edge of the sink as he went down. The snake whipped away and found a spot in the opposite corner of the stockroom, where it coiled and watched Sal twitch on the floor. Born and raised in the city, Sal had never met a snake in person before. So far, he did not care for them. The chief said to me, she said, "You're going to put me through the third degree after giving me the razzmatazz all night on the sand like a hobo?" It was maybe 6 in the morning, and we were on the streetcar, headed back to North Beach. I would have sprung for a cab, but you try to catch a cab by the beach at 6 in the morning. The cheese had her hair pinned up in that fountain of curls way I like, but otherwise she looked like maybe someone had given her the razzmatazz on the sand, like a hobo. Her dress looked like it had been wadded up and stored in a cat box with the cat, and there was a little half-moon of lipstick on one of her nostrils. I don't know how it got there, but I was loath to apprise her of it, as she was already somewhat peeved with me. First, it was swell, and second, I was a gentleman and let you be on top, so perhaps it is you who are giving me the razzmatazz in the sand.
Swell, was it? Then why the interrogation?
I was just wondering how that artist knew you worked in the shipyard. He drew you without hardly looking, like he'd done it before.
So you want me to say I've been to Playland with another guy? Yeah, I have. And maybe they wanted a keepsake before going off to war, so maybe I sat for that guy before.
They? I said. I didn't want to know, but I asked. I thought about some mug in a foxhole on some godforsaken island in the Pacific, bleeding to death all over a pinup of the cheese. Still, I couldn't stop myself. "More than one?" I asked. There was an old couple leaning on each other at the other end of the car, like they could be sleeping. Or maybe someone had loaded them dead onto the streetcar for a ride to the cemetery, because they had not moved since we boarded. The old guy's hat was pulled down over his eyes. The old broad wore a scarf around her head that made her look like one of those French peasants you see in paintings. Yeah, they could have been dead.
"What if there was more than one?" said the cheese. "It was a long war, and I was lonely. Guys shipping out were scared they might never see home again. So yeah, I gave him something nice to remember. If that makes you some kind of floozy in your mind, then maybe you need to rethink how you got that picture."
Stilton nodded toward the lapel of my overcoat. I noticed the old broad at the other end of the streetcar opened an eye when the word floozy was used, and closed it real fast when I looked at her. So not dead. I was not relieved, not at all. I was standing over the cheese, hanging onto a pole, and I felt like I was going to be sick. "So that's it," I said. "You felt sorry for me?"
"Nah, that ain't it at all," said the cheese. "I like you, Sammy. I like you a lot. But you know how it was."
She took a breath, like it was my turn to say something, but I didn't. So she jumped in like she was rescuing me.
"I don't know how horrible it was for you over there, and I ain't gonna ask. But at least you came home. At least you can laugh. And you make me laugh. But some of those guys probably had the last laugh they were ever gonna have the night before they shipped out. You can't be mad about that."
But I could, I guess. I'd no right to be, but I was mad. Maybe not so much mad, but empty. Like my chest was caving in on me. See, for a little bit there, the whole world was me and the cheese. And I was just fine with that. Suddenly, there were all these other guys in it, haunting it like ghosts. I had nothing to say. So I sat down, not on the seat with her, but across the aisle. I was feeling like a boot full of shit. Hold a boot. I just sat there, my legs across a couple of seats, my feet out in the aisle, looking at my shoes. I said nothing. The cheese said nothing. People got out in the streetcar. People got off. People shuffled and muttered and read the paper. The dead couple ambled off. The woman looked back, gave me a scowl as she stepped down to the street. "Save the stink eye, Grandma. I got a whole lifetime of it waiting in the mirror when I get home." After Van Ness Avenue, Stilton pulled the cord, rang the bell. The driver stopped at the next block at the intersection of Market and Polk.
"I'll just get off here," Stilton said. "My uniform's at work. I'll just get ready there."
"Yeah. I get off at Grant," I said. That was all. She tapped my foot with her finger as she went by.
"See you around sometime," she said.
"Yeah," said I. "Watch your step," called the driver. I watched the cheese step off the streetcar and look back over her shoulder, eyes hooded, like she was ashamed. And I felt as if I just threw a rock and busted out the streetlight that was the only light in my miserable life. When I got home, the kid was curled up in front of my door like a sleeping squirrel, his butt in the air, his newsboy cap on the floor in front of him. I didn't know why the kid's mom hadn't let him in last night, or why he didn't let himself into my place with his key. But I was tired enough to drop off right there in the hall beside him. So I unlocked the door, picked the kid up by the back of his overalls, and set him inside my apartment. I kicked his cap inside and locked the door behind us. If I left the kid outside, he was likely as not to get eaten by rats, and as beat as I was, there was no way I would make it to work in time without the kid's wake-up services. I left him there on the floor, sawing logs in one of those soft kid snores, like you hear from a puppy, or maybe a baby pig, because every minute or so he let out a little snort. Point is, he didn't miss a beat, and I was a little jealous that he slept the sleep of the innocent, as they say, despite the fact that he is a horrible little kid. Oh, I slept all right. But it was the jangled sleep of a mug who had just ruined the best thing that had ever happened to him. And it seemed like as soon as I closed my eyes, the kid was pounding on my door and yelling like the place was on fire. Kid must have gone out while I slept. My watch said I'd been asleep for 7 hours, but it felt like 7 minutes. And 4 of those hours were acid stomach and regret. "I'm up, kid," I said, throwing open the door. "Why didn't you use your key?" The kid rolled by me like I was a shadow and headed for the icebox. "I might have lost it," he said. I ain't saying. He was already pulling out the milk and a loaf of bread I keep in the icebox to discourage the weevils and whatnot. You're out of cornflakes. Leave me a little extra cabbage, and I'll pick some up for you. No extra charge.
There's sugar. Make some milk toast, I told him. But he already had two slices under the broiler and was about to turn on the gas. Look, kid, I gotta get in the shower. I grabbed my pants off the chair and pulled a buck out of my wallet and put it on the enamel drain board. Get some cornflakes, some butter, and go to the hardware store and get a key made. I put my key on the drain board next to the dollar. You can handle that, right?
What am I, some kind of slave? I ain't your errand boy. I ain't some kind of dirty Marx Capone.
That's a cheese, kid.
No, it ain't.
A pain hit me in the temples like someone was shooting hot rivets into my coconut, and it wasn't from the old tennis shoes. Look, kid, the key's for you. That stuff is for you.
Why'd you sleep in the hall last night? None of your business. My ma might be on a mission with Uncle Clement.
The Pope?
Very hush-hush.
The kid was watching his toast like it was a science experiment, leaning so close to the broiler the brim of his cap gave off a little puff of smoke.
Had to leave fast. Locked me out on accident. What are you gonna do?
Dames can get daffy when the chips are down. I was about to say, tell me about it. I was about to say that maybe it wasn't his fault he was a horrible little kid, because his mother was a horrible mother. But, yeah, what are you gonna do? I said as I headed for the shower. When I came out, the kid was on his second round of milk toast. He slurped while I dressed.
Where's your cane?
Left it at work. Get that key made, kid, and leave mine under the mat.
I gotta listen to your radio tonight. See if the flying saucers are attacking. You can't see them coming from here on account of the city lights. That's how they get you.
I started to tell him to keep his dirty ears off my radio, as is my policy, but then I said, yeah, you keep an ear out, kid. Just turn it off when you're done. You burn out a tube, it comes out of your pay.
Try and get it, you dirty Manchego.
Also a cheese.
No, it ain't, you lousy.
I closed the door on the kid's rant. 2 steps into the street, I was feeling like I should head over to the Five and Dime on Polk Street and throw myself on Stilton's mercy, beg her to forgive me, tell her I made the mistake of my life and I was not a war veteran and I was a liar and bum. Broads love that. Probably. But I couldn't dump a load of trouble on her like a bucket of chum. It would stink. It ain't right. So I headed on to Sales, and as I walked, I waved to the guys I know on the street. Hey, Vinny, how's your mother? Tony, how's it hanging? Hey, Enzo, Ba Fangu, you fucking dagoed fuck. I can say this because when Sal hired me, I told him that my family name was originally Tufelo, not Tiffin. So he welcomed me into Goomba society, and everyone in the neighborhood thinks I am Italian. I do not disabuse them of this ruse. So as I went, waving, speaking pidgin Italian, I realized I usually tipped my cane, and all of a sudden I wished I had my cane, because I was limping and my foot hurt. I thought of Stilton at the lunch counter, dealing plates off her arm all day while I was sleeping, having to deal with various mooks, mugs, and unsavory citizens while hurt. And I knew she was hurt, worse than my stupid foot, because she was a good kid, maybe a little daffy, sad daffy like Milo said, but sweet daffy. I'm no good for her, and I know it. When I got to Sal's, the front door was closed, locked, the clothes sign still hanging there in the window. I figured maybe Sal had stepped out for a minute, but usually he just locked the cash register and had one of the day drunks keep an eye on things until he got back. Around the back, the door was not locked. It wasn't even completely closed. Something was propping it open about 4 inches. A shoe. It was a shoe that Sal Gabelli was wearing, and from the off-blue color of his skin, I could tell right away that Sal was more than somewhat dead. So here I found the aforementioned snake crate sans Black Mamba and determined that the snake might indeed still be in the saloon and indulged in 2 burly man-screams in quick succession, one upon finding Sal and the other upon running into the 2 tall goons in black standing in my way as I headed out to find Mooshoes and inform him that our business venture had croaked my boss and also that we had a business venture. The goons were nonplussed by my manly scream, but they recovered before I did. And while I tried to pull the door shut behind me, one stepped in my way.
Are you Sal Gabelli?
Nope, I said. Sal took a day off.
Who are you?
Asked the other tall guy. The only way I could tell them apart is that this one had thick eyebrows above his sunglasses. The other had eyebrows like a dame draws on with a pencil. I'm the janitor, I said.
despite that I was wearing my bartender black and whites, including a vest, bow tie, and garters on my sleeves, although I had not donned my apron due to the interruption of the corpse and so forth. "When will Sal be back?" asked Thin Brows. "I don't know, maybe Monday. I'm just the janitor." Thick Brows took a notebook out of his jacket pocket and wrote something down with a short pencil. "Did you just write down that I am the janitor?"
"And the date and time," said Thick Brows.
They did not ask my name. They did not question that I was the janitor when I was not wearing proper janitor togs, nor did they identify themselves, but they were writing down the time, and I guessed that they talked to the janitor. They didn't notice that I was sweating like a whore in church, despite the cool weather, and they didn't ask. So they weren't cops, unless they were really bad at it, and they were wound entirely too tightly for wise guys, but the suits, the hats, the sunglasses were matched, like uniforms, right down to the spit-shine floor shimes. Maybe, I thought, they are from one of those loopy churches that send guys in ties out into the jungle to convert cannibals and so forth. Maybe Sal was running a game on them. "Can I give Sal a message for you?" I said. "Tell him you'll stop by?" "No, don't do that," said Thin Brows.
"We'll be back," said Thick Brows.
"Okie dokie," I said. "I gotta scram, guys," I said. "Another job. Go with God or whatever." And I pushed my way past them and headed up to Broadway, my heart still beating like Gene Krupa in my chest. Definitely loopy church guys. Chapter 11. How to Ice a Guy. Turns out I can scamper like a champ without my cane after I've had a scare, so I made quick time to Club Shanghai, where the doorman gave me the hairy eyeball as I blew past him. Eddie wasn't at the host's podium, but the young guy was. I didn't remember his name. "Hey, Skippy, Eddie around?"
"Name's Lou," said the kid.
Now I remembered.
"I thought it was Lou."
"Not anymore," he said. "Eddie's in the lounge."
He tossed his head toward the door to the side. The cocktail lounge was all red velvet and gold dragons, less sparkly than the main room. Eddie was standing at a dark oak bar next to Lois Fong, who was not yet in her evening clothes, but who looked very well put together indeed, even in her day outfit, which involved a sage-green linen dress and a pair of dark-green platform Mary Janes, the heels of which were high enough to give vertigo to a mountain goat. She sat at the bar with her heels hooked into the brass rungs of her stool.
"Kid, would you get Eddie for me? Tell him I need to talk to him a second."
"You can go on in."
"Nah, I don't think Lois likes me, and he looks like he's making time. Tell him it will just be a second."
I took a few steps back toward the door, the carpet so soft and thick it reminded me of the floor in the funhouse last night. Like meatloaf, the cheese had said, and I felt a stab in my heart.
"What's shaking, bacon?" said Mooshoes.
Red silk jacket, gold lamé bow tie, black and white wingtips, of course. "Trouble," I said.
"That other thing? Because we should mention that other thing, my uncle."
"No, not that," I said.
"Dame trouble again?"
"Yes, but no, different trouble."
"Confess, sinner."
"Where'd you get that?"
"Bing Crosby movie. Maybe, I don't know. What's the song, Armstrong? I gotta get back to Lois. She's telling me her woes. Things are looking up."
Lou came back to the podium, and Eddie waved him off.
"Take five, Lou," Eddie said. "I got this."
Lou took a powder. To me, Mushu said,
"So?"
"Sal Gabelli might be dead." This was clearly not what Mushu's expected, and he did a double take.
"Might be dead in that he is missing, or might be dead in that someone has put him in a sack and dropped him in the bay, which is understandable. Or might be dead like he's in the hospital with a bum ticket, and he has only hours left."
"Might be dead in that he is definitely dead, in the back room of Sal's."
"Whoa."
Mooshoes looked around, peeked back into the lounge, gave Lois a wave and a wink. "He'll be right back, then."
"What the hell, Sammy, did you kill him?"
"No, good." "Well, yes, well, kind of."
"How did you kind of kill him? Because if it was an accident, well, we killed him."
"We?
You and that cheese dame?"
"No, we, like, you and me."
"Look, pal, you know I'd stand up for you, but you kill a guy."
"It was our snake," I interrupted. "Our snake killed Sal." Mooshoes was a little stunned. I saw this, and I gave him a second to collect his thoughts. But then Lois Fong peeked her head around the corner.
"Eddie, I need to talk to you."
I realized I'd have to throw a block for a pal or Mushu's was going to lose ground with the object of his infection. Lois, I said, leaving Eddie standing and moving up to Lois, using my best condolences voice, if you could just give us a minute. I got a personal situation, and Eddie is giving me advice like he does so well, okay? She stepped back into the lounge.
Okay, I guess. But Eddie, I gotta get ready for work soon.
Mushu's nodded, smiled, put a finger in the air. Be there in a minute.
Our snake?
He said. Yeah, we have a snake. Deadly, poisonous black mamba.
A snake?
Yeah. Remember that South African merchant marine who was at sales the other night? The one with all the animals? Well,
so you bought a snake.
It was your idea, I said.
How in the hell could it be my idea if I'm just now hearing about it?
Because you took me to the noodle place with all the snake whiz at 20 bucks a scoop. So I figure it was an investment.
Wait, this was the angle you were talking about when you wanted to pay Uncle Mao in snake whiz? So you bought a snake?
That is what I'm saying.
And it killed Sal?
In my defense, I said, the snake was addressed to me. There was even a note saying to be careful. Sal completely ignored the note and opened the crate.
You had it delivered to Sal's?
Yeah, I figured it was safer than my place. My place, they would just leave it outside on the stoop. You can't just leave a valuable snake lying around. Someone will...
So the snake bit Sal and now he's dead?
That is true. Back room of the saloon.
And where is the snake?
Dunno. Maybe he's still in Sal's.
With Sal's dead body?
So you see the problem?
Yes, Eddie said. I see the problem. The cops are going to be looking all over for you.
Not necessarily, I say. I mean, there's no way to prove it was our snake.
Except it was addressed to you.
That's it. I'll make like someone was trying to kill me, but Sal opened the box and saved me.
No one will believe that, said Mushu's.
Eddie?
Lois whined from the doorway. I went over and took her hand gently, like I was leading her onto the dance floor. Come here, doll, just a little bit more. You know what a sharp operator Eddie is, right? Well, I really need just another minute with him, and he'll help me out, and then he's all yours.
Well, all right.
Lois pouted and took little pouty steps back to the bar. I turned back to Mushu's. So I need you to help me get rid of the body.
What? No, I don't know how to get rid of a body.
Yeah, but you know a guy, right?
Why would I know about that? I grew up in the laundry business.
But you're an operator, Eddie.
No, I'm not.
Well, you would have been if this snake deal had worked out. What about your uncle?
Yes, maybe.
Mushu's was cogitating.
No, he specializes.
What? He specializes in drugging a kidnapped cop and keeping him gacked on smack until we can figure out what to do with him, but he can't handle one lousy dead guy?
Not a dead white guy.
What, he's good enough to take my money for drugs, but he can't soil his delicate hands on a corpse? The nerve.
No, Yanglo mugs are too big.
Nonsense. Sal doesn't go $1.50 soaking wet. And he's already down a couple of quarts. I'd say 140 maximum.
Ho says it takes too long for the pigs to eat a white devil.
Maybe since we're regular customers, he bends policy?
He won't do it. In fact, he wants more money if he's going to keep Pookie a few more days. Says he has to bring him around enough to pour some water into him, or else he'll dry up and die.
Well, we're fucked then, I said. Because then we've got two bodies, and Pookie is huge.
Eddie...
Lois whined. You are gonna need to fuck right off, Lois, I barked. Right now. Just give us one fucking minute. I may have been somewhat less delicate than I had intended in answering Lois's concerns.
Try low,
Lois muttered as she hurried away. I heard that. I know what that means. I am not a white devil.
Oh, shit, now you've done it, Eddie said.
Sorry, pal.
The money, Eddie said.
I don't have any, I said.
I lent you $100 the other night.
I know. Why did you make me buy noodles?
I told you I needed to look broke. That's not the point.
I spent it on the snake, along with a C-note of my own.
You spent $200 on a snake?
It's a first-rate snake, as I think we can see now.
Eddie!
Mushu's wheeled on the dancer.
Scram, Lois, this is business. I'll be there in a second.
She sniffled and started to cry as she ran away. Mushu's turned on me then. And I had to take a step back, because I was not entirely sure he was not going to sock me in the choppers for wrecking his woo. But he tightened down all of a sudden and got very scary and whispery with me, which I had not seen before, and which unsettled me more than somewhat.
You've got to get back to work.
If sales isn't open, people get wise. You already got them looking for a guy with a cane. Hey, where's your cane?
Don't need it.
Good. Hide sales body, open the saloon, work your shift, and we'll figure out what to do tonight after work.
What if the snake is still in there?
Then catch it.
I don't know how to catch a snake. It's probably a big snake. Barker said he'd get a big one. And it's probably angry because it's still got sales taste in its mouth.
Use a broom or something.
A broom?
Yeah, I'll call you later.
What about the scrotum guys?
Who are the scrotum guys?
The old guys, the noodle joint. The ones who look like they are made out of scrotum skin.
That's disrespectful, Sammy. Those are my venerated elders.
They drink snake piss, Eddie. How venerated is that? This is mostly their fault.
How is this their fault?
Supply and demand. Don't they teach basic economics in Chinatown?
Go to work. Don't get killed. I'll see what I can do. I'll call you.
Tell Lois I'm sorry. I've been a little edgy lately.
I'll tell her I'm going to have your arms broken.
Sure, that's a good angle.
I just need to find the money to pay a guy.
So just like that, Mooshoes went after Lois and left me to find my way back to sales, with no help at all. When you hear guys say that a guy got put in a sack, it sounds much more simple than it actually is. Or so it occurred to me as the evening passed. I was completely calmed down by the time I got back to sales, and there was no sign of the two guys in the sunglasses. Just a few sad dogs sitting vigil, or maybe waiting for dog pizza. Anyway, I let myself in the back, looking around a little bit to make sure that the black mamba was not waiting behind the door to scrag me like it did Sal. But the coast was clear. I stepped over the aforementioned Sal, who, to my surprise, seemed less than concerned with my bad manners. Then I grabbed the mop by the big laundry sink by his head. There was a little hair and blood there on the corner of the sink. So with the keen Sherlockish detective powers that I have honed over several years of forklift driving, ship welding, and bartending, I deduced that Sal had banged his melon on the way down, thus making for the small, serviette-sized puddle of gore on the floor by his face. I figured I had an hour to get the saloon ready and open before the after-work regulars started to think something was up, and with all due respect for the dead, I did not mop up around Sal right away because I did not care to be surprised during clean-up by the Black Mamba. So I brandished the mop as my weapon of choice in battling the deadliest snake known to man, as evidenced by the deceased douchebag under the sink. I thought maybe if I found it, maybe it would bite the mop head instead of me. And meanwhile, I would run outside and come up with a different plan. The South Africans said they can outrun a man. But how are they with doorknobs, huh? I grabbed a leather jacket out of the lost and found and put that on for protection. Then I commenced to look around every corner, under every table, behind every stool, and every cabinet, opening the doors and leaping back, mop in hand, ready to run. Half an hour later, and there was no snake, although I did surprise a small gray mouse in a cabinet under the back bar, and introduce him to my aforementioned giant dick-in-the-door man-scream, which sent us both scurrying off. So the coast being relatively clear, it was time to deal with Sal. Sal was never the best-smelling mug under normal circumstances, but now he had gone quite overripe indeed. There was a drain in the floor under the sink, so I commenced to dash buckets of warm soapy water over him until he was quite refreshed, although somewhat damp. He would not remain so fresh, I guessed, until closing time, and besides, a customer at the end of the bar would be able to spot Sal lying in repose under the sink, and curiosity would ensue. So I needed to move him. As I may have mentioned, I have limited experience in the hiding of stiffs, so a good hiding spot did not immediately come to mind. Then there it was, like the Holy Grail, or the magic words. Or free nookie, which I suppose could also be the magic words. Shortly after the war ended, when Sal first hired me, there came on the market many surplus machines no longer required to defeat the Axis powers. Among these were battleships, bombers, tanks, flamethrowers, atom bombs, and ice machines. And it was the last that Sal decided he needed for a saloon, as the price was so low as to make it almost free, especially considering the savings of not having to have ice delivered every day. And there it stood, too big to fit under the bar, too big even to get through the door into the front room. Originally designed to make life somewhat less hellish for mugs in the Pacific campaign, it stood in the corner of the stockroom, opposite the sink, chugging and hissing, and making various crashing noises all day, all night, every day. Roughly three times the size of a normal fridge, it had a bin that was supposed to hold 500 pounds of ice, and now, I hoped, would also accommodate its owner. There was no way I was going to get dead Wet Sal in there by myself and still be presentable for work in half an hour. So I stripped to my skivvies, folding my bartender togs and leaving them out on the bar. Then I returned to the back room, hoisted Sal from under the armpits, and dragged him over to the machine. It turns out that the term stiff is not entirely a metaphor, which is to say, in the intervening time since he last drew breath, Sal had become quite rigid. The ice machine's hatchway was about 3 feet off the floor and covered by a heavy door that clunked shut when dropped into place. While quite serviceable for passing a small bucket or steam tray through, it was not the ideal portal through which to pass a rigorously mortared douchebag, and I let loose at a couple of technicolor roars into the sink during the process. Thus I was enlightened as to how difficult indeed it would be to put a guy in a sack, when I couldn't even get a well-lubricated welterweight into an ice machine. And it was occurring to me that perhaps I did not have the stomach for cutting parts off of Sal to get him in the ice machine, even if the paring knife we used for cutting lemons was sharpened up considerably, when the phone rang. I left Sal hanging mostly out of the machine while I went to answer it. "Sal," I said.
"May I speak to Mr. Gabelli, please?"
said a woman, very official and serious. "Mr. Gabelli just stepped out," I told her. "May I take a message?"
"Please have him call this number as soon as possible," she said.
Then she gave me the number, which I wrote down on a notepad we keep by the phone for just such things. "Who should he ask for?"
"Just have him say who is calling, and I will direct his call."
"Sure thing," I told her. She hung up, and I held down the phone cradle for a 5 count before I dialed the number she gave me.
"Stoddard, Whittaker, and Croc,"
answered the same dame who just hung up on me. So without a word, I returned the favor. What is Sal doing mixed up with a law firm? A law firm who doesn't want to give me their name. I figured I'd ponder it later and went back to the task at hand. When I returned to Sal, I saw the solution. Right there in front of me was a perfectly serviceable snake trait. And no snake. And I would only have to bend Sal in one place to get him in there, which was easily achieved by laying him flat across the top of the crate, and then jumping on him. Before you can say Jack Robinson, Sal was sitting peacefully in the crate, which I moved over by the drain for meltage, and I was pouring buckets of ice over him. By the time it was time to flip the open sign, Sal's bald spot was the only thing showing above the ice, so I put the lid on the snake crate and tapped it down with a crowbar to give him his privacy. I mopped the sweat off me with a bar towel. Then, as I was pulling on my trousers, the phone rang again.
"Tammy," said Moose Shoes. "I got good news."
Moose sounded like he had a hot tip on a fast horse. "Swell," I said.
"Well, they found a guy dead in an alley off Kearney Street. Chinese guy."
"So not a tip on a horse." "That's terrific, Moo, but I'm a little busy."
"That's it. You still looking for your snake?"
"Kind of. I looked everywhere, but I don't know how good they hide. I'm about to open up. I want to get some people in here, so if he decides to bite someone, there's less chance it will be me."
"Well, don't worry about it. He's not there. The dead guy they found died of snake bite. He wasn't dead when they found him, but soon after, so they know it's a really deadly snake. All the old guys in Chinatown are buzzing about it."
I feel bad. I did feel bad. A little relieved, but bad.
"No, that's the good news. They all want in."
"Who all want in?"
"The old guys at the juke place."
"The nutsack skin guys?"
"Don't call them that, but yeah, those guys."
"What about the cops, the papers?"
"This is Chinatown. Nothing gets out. Those guys don't want it to. They aren't going to risk losing a snake like that."
"But we don't have the snake."
"I know. We have to catch it. So I talked to Uncle Mao. He wants to help us."
"I thought he specialized."
"Yeah, this is one of his specialties."
"Oh, good," I said, although I was not feeling as if this was good news. "Will he throw in getting rid of a body?"
"Don't know. What about Sal?"
"Still dead. I iced him down."
"I had an idea," Moo said. "What if we take him out and drop him in the woods somewhere? In Marin or the East Bay up by Piedmont or something. By the time someone finds him, they'll just think that he was bitten by a snake in the wild."
"Won't work. Sal has never been out of the city in his life. Everyone will know it's a setup." Suddenly there was a clicking on the line, loud, like Moo hung up.
"Sammy?" Moo said.
"Yeah, I'm here. You hear that?"
"Yeah, it's probably one of the Chinatown operators. They listen in sometimes."
"Maybe we better not talk about this on the phone anymore, huh?"
"Right, I'll see you after work."
"Right, see you then. Can you come here? Bring a car?"
"Nah, you come here. Besides, I don't drive."
"You drove the other night when we snatched Pookie."
"Well, yeah, but that was just to keep you from killing us. I really don't know how."
"Oh,
I said.
Right.
Did you call Sal's wife? Mu asked. She'll be wondering where he is.
Oh, balls. I didn't think about that, I said. I'd better do that. See you tonight.
I saw silhouettes through the stained glass of the door. Customers waiting for me to open. And despite it all the panic and scurrying, my heart jumped at the thought that one of them might belong to the cheese.
Chapter 12. Pang Mao.
Poor Sammy. His boss was dead. His snake was missing. He had no money to pay Ho, the cat-fucking uncle, for the upkeep of his kidnapped cop. And there was no cheese outside his door. When he opened the bar, he was greeted by normal thirsty citizens, many of whom were annoyed that Sal's did not open up earlier. So Sammy appeased them with free spirits and a serviceable story about a Sal that had a loss in the family, which story had the added value of being partially true, that loss being Sal. Also, Sammy's bad foot hurt, and he had thrown his only cane in the sewer, so he was limping to the point of looking like he was skipping up and down behind the bar. Still, he was getting into the rhythm of the job, pouring drinks, washing glasses, talking small, when two uniformed cops darkened the door like a thunderstorm fat with doom. All the patrons piped down to a whisper. Even guys not discussing something illegal put on the hush, so more industrious criminals didn't take them for rats.
"How can I get you, officers?" said Sammy, beaming smiles of innocence and goodwill.
"We're on duty," said the junior cop, gangly and barely old enough to shave.
"Just beer, then?" Sammy grinned.
Young cop cracked a smile.
"You seen Pookie O'Hara?"
asked the older cop. Tough-looking bullet head. Little to no neck. Sammy searched the ceiling as if that was where he kept his memory. "Big as a house, nose like a road map, suit looks like he's been sleeping in it since before the war."
"That's the one," said the young cop.
"Never heard of him," Sammy said. Bullethead hitched up his gun belt.
"Listen, wise guy."
Sammy grinned, held up his hands, big smile.
"Just kidding."
"Yeah, he was in here. I don't know, 4 or 5 days ago. Had a short one and was in the wind."
"He say anything?"
"Yeah. He gives me a nice tip and says to tell Sal he stopped by."
"That's it."
"I bought breakfast and a paper with the tip."
"Did he say anything else?"
"Nope."
"Is this Sal around?"
And here Sammy suddenly had an idea that flashed in his head like flickering, dying neon, and also made that annoying buzzing noise, but he pushed through and said, "Nah, you know, Sal said he was going to take off somewhere. Up north, I think. And I think Pookie was going with him. That's why Pookie was looking for him, I think."
"Up north where?"
"Don't know. But Sal had me open up late today. Didn't work his shift. He usually opens in the morning. Maybe they're fishing or something." The two cops looked at each other, looked at Sammy like he had just farted.
"Fishing?" said Bullethead.
"I don't know," Sammy said. "I'm just a night bartender. I'm just trying to help." Bullethead nodded.
"We'll look into it."
They started to go, and then the younger cop stopped at the door.
"Hey," he said. "You know a thin guy walks with a cane?"
Sammy stopped breathing. All the regulars in the place, who were concentrating on minding their own business, stopped breathing. Sammy shook his head.
"A lot of thin guys walking with canes since the war. You got anything else? Age? Hair color?"
"Nah," said the young cop.
"Witness thought they saw a guy clocking Pookie with a cane a couple of nights ago."
Sammy stared into the bin of bottle caps by the opener, like he was thinking hard. "Check down on 3rd Street by the soup kitchen," Sammy was thinking.
"This witness must have been corned up to the gills if he sees a skinny guy with a cane but misses completely the enormous black guy in a penguin suit who actually rings Pookie's goodnight bell."
Sammy said, "You can't flick a butt down on 3rd without hitting a guy in a cane or crutches."
"Yeah, thanks for nothing," said the young cop.
Bullethead pushed through the door, disgusted. They were gone. Sammy turned to check on his customers, and everyone was looking at him.
"What?"
"Wasn't me." A couple of dozen eyebrows went up.
"It wasn't.
I don't even walk with a cane anymore." Bunch of guys coughed politely, lit smokes, waited. "Around on the house," Sammy exclaimed, and everyone started talking and calling out drinks and telling lies, and a good time was had by one and all. A half an hour after the Flatfoots left, I followed through with my plan by calling Sal's wife, who I met exactly one time, when she came into the bar one day to get cash from Sal for groceries. She seemed okay.
Hello, she said. She sounded peeved. Mrs. Gabelli, this is Sammy down at the bar. Sorry to bother you, but Sal asked me to give you a call.
Yeah?
Why? Well, he was running out to go fishing with some friends, and he's going to be gone. I tried to figure how long I could push this, how much time I could buy. At least until Monday. Gave me 2 more days.
Yeah, I know, said Mrs. Gabelli. You do?
Yeah. But he told me it was camping.
Yeah, right, the douchebag wouldn't know a sleeping bag from a soda bottle.
So he told you to tell me he was fishing. Good for you, kid.
Could have been camping, I said.
You know Sal.
Sal's wife even called him a douchebag.
I'm thinking maybe the snake did everyone a favor.
If I need him, I'll just call down to Mabel's. They'll pretend he's not there, and he'll be home in an hour.
Okay, Mr. Gabelli, he just asked me to call you.
Yeah, if you see him, tell him I said to piss up a rope.
Yes, ma'am, I said. So compared to getting Sam to the ice machine, consoling his widow seemed like a piece of cake. So my career in crime, away alertly, as they say in horse racing, was around midnight when I decided that I would perpetrate my first robbery. Mooshoes and I needed to raise numerous ducats with which to pay upkeep on our kidnapped Flatfoot. Since it seemed unlikely that Sal would be requiring operating cash, I decided that he was going to donate the contents of the cash register to Pookie's upkeep. But as I counted down the drawer a couple of hours before closing, and I had the few drunks still in the bar, I realized that we were going to come up short by several sawbucks, and I guessed that Uncle Mao would not float us the difference. After I booted everyone out, I proceeded to look for the remaining funds. As any experienced robber will tell you, if you're going to lift a guy's wallet, it is wise to do so before you pack him under numerous buckets of ice in a snake crate. Because when you return several hours later, you will find that the ice has melted into a somewhat solid block, which requires quite a bit of attention with an ice pick before the wallet is liberated. Although more or less blue, Sal appeared as fresh as when he was first packaged, discounting minor blemishes caused by a few less than precise plunges of the ice pick. And boom, I had enough money to pay Uncle Mao and pocket a few ducats for myself, a Sagi driver's license, and a lifetime membership card to the Knights of Columbus, which will come in handy if I ever need to sit around and smoke cigars with a bunch of ancient Goombas. The clock was creeping up on 3. I was supposed to catch up with Mooshoes at Club Shanghai, but I couldn't do it, not without checking on her. Fast as I could, I packed Sal back in ice to his crown, and before I put the lid back on the snake crate, I admitted to Sal that he was right about buying a military-grade ice machine, because without it, none of this would be possible. I left my other side work undone, stepped into the alley and locked the door. The bakery down the street was proofing their bread, and you could smell the yeast in the air, along with a hint of cinnamon, which must have come from something else they were fixing up for the morning. It was clear out, but cool, which I was grateful for, because before I got halfway up the stairs to the top of Telegraph Hill, I had my overcoat over my shoulder, and my shirt was steaming with sweat. The whole climb and half the way down, I was practicing groveling in my head. The closer I got to the top of the hill, the more desperate and panicky I felt. What if she said no? No second chance. Would I beg? Maybe I wouldn't start with begging, but I'd get there quick. Or maybe she'd give me a break and it would start with a big back-breaking smooch and we'd be off to the races again. Well, maybe I'd get there and she'd be doing the razzmatazz with some other mug. And I'd stand outside the window as pieces of my heart broke and fell on the little stepping stones in the garden. Now, even thinking that made me want to collapse and roll down the hill and just fucking die like a dog in the dirt. When I got to her place, there were no lights on at all. No sound from inside. I listened at the door for a second, caught my breath, then knocked softly-like.
Stilton.
A whisper. Another light tap.
Come on. Toots.
Couldn't help it, I smiled, thinking she might be smiling inside. But she wasn't. 5 or 6 more tries, tapping with apologies. Then I tried the knob. Unlocked. Without her in there, her little dugout apartment felt like a grave. The bed was made. It looked like a kid's bed. Small and neat and unruffled. A white chenille bedspread looking like it was fresh off the line, like it would be undisturbed forever. Like the bed of a kid who drowned, that was being kept just like it always was. Like a bed for a kid who would never come home. Holy shit, I had to get out of there. There was a book of order tickets on her little kitchen table, and a pencil in a cup. I left her a note. I'm sorry.
and I'm sorry and I'm sorry and I want to see you. And I signed it. I love you, Sammy. And I was out of there and down her side of the hill to Kearney Street as fast as I could go without tumbling ass over tea kettle and breaking my neck. Although right then I was thinking maybe it wouldn't be such a bad move, given my situation. By the time I got to Club Shanghai, the doorman had gone home, and I just waltzed in like I was dragging of the walk. Eddie Mooshoes was at the host station alone. He looked up, gave me the just-a-minute finger in the air, then called something into the cocktail lounge.